rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org and whiterosesociety.org. Now podcasting also from Apple iTunes. Welcome to our program. Pleased to have you with us today. Why did George W. Bush go to war? And what has it meant to some of our families? George W. Bush, back when he was claiming, now we know, lying, that he didn't want to go to war.
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
And Cindy Sheehan would like to know, if he made that decision, why? What was it about? Cindy Sheehan is with us from Camp Casey. Cindy Sheehan, one of the co-founders of Gold Star Families for Peace, the mother of Casey, who died 16 months ago in Iraq. Cindy, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's nice to talk to you again.
It's good to have you back here on the program. First of all, just a quick update. We spoke yesterday, although it was on my local program. I played a clip of it here on this national show, so I think people are up to date on our conversation yesterday. What's going on at Camp Casey there outside Bush's hobby farm? I hesitate to call it a ranch because he's afraid of horses, but in any case, outside of Bush's residence there in Crawford, Texas.
Well, I just think it's so funny that he loved to play cowboy and he loved to play with his G.I. Joes, and he is just so phony and unauthentic. It's just, you know, truly sickening. But as we've had a very quiet day today so far. Yesterday we got rousted out by the sheriffs, and that was pretty disturbing. We were told on Saturday exactly where we could put our things and where we could put our tents and everything, mm-hmm. because it was county property. And now they came back yesterday and they tell us that it's private property. So on Saturday it was county property and yesterday it was private property. And I just cannot believe that the sheriff's department of a town where George Bush lived would not know the status of the road, whether it was private property or county property. So we got squeezed onto just a narrow space in a ditch where we can stay. And if they think any of this stuff is going to make us leave, you know, I don't even know why they're pulling these stunts on us, because we're not leaving.
Cindy Sheehan, I just have to absolutely salute you. I want to tell you, you are one of my heroes. You are one of the extraordinary, you know, in every moment of history, there are those extraordinary people who stand up and say, the buck stops here. I am standing here. I am taking a principled stand, and you are one of them. You are extraordinary.
That's what I thought. Enough is enough. I can't take this anymore.
Yeah.
You know, and also, I don't know if, since I talked to you yesterday, we got word that if we're still there on Thursday, we're going to be deemed a security threat. And if we don't leave, we're going to be arrested. And you know what? They're going to have to carry me to the squad car. And I hope there's a lot of media there. But I really hope that they have more brains than to have me arrested. But you know what? Nobody's ever accused this president or his administration of having any brains or compassion.
Which raises the question. Yesterday, there was a fair amount of coverage of you and what you're doing down there. Here in Portland, Oregon, locally on our local program, the Local 72 of the Veterans for Peace, VFP, is having a vigil today here in Portland, Oregon. We just interviewed the president of Local 72 on my local program from noon to 1. They're going to be out in front of the federal building in Oregon. I understand there are similar vigils, Standing with Cindy, they call it, happening around the United States. So you've got a lot of people in solidarity with you around the country. But then after I got off the air, I went home and turned on the news and looked at CNN and MSNBC and ABC, and I admit I didn't watch all the networks and all the newscasts, but I didn't see one mention of what's going on down there, of what you're doing. Do you think that you're going to be able to crack through the barrier of silence in the corporate conservative mainstream media?
Well, what is so strange too is that yesterday I was scheduled to do the Today Show on NBC in the morning. They never showed up. I was scheduled to do the Hartwell Day Council. I was scheduled to do because on MSNBC. They never showed up. And I was scheduled to do an interview for MSNBC. They canceled.
You're starting to break up here, Cindy. You were scheduled to be on Hardball, and they canceled you?
Hardball canceled. Connected Coast to Coast just never showed up. The Today Show never showed up. And MSNBC Live canceled. So I was supposed to do four NBC things yesterday, and they just blew me off or canceled. And I'm just wondering if it's because they're owned by General Electric, they're a huge defense contractor, and they have a huge stake in keeping this war going.
Yeah, General Electric is making a very substantial profit on this war in Iraq, and they own NBC and MSNBC. Could have something to do with it, or maybe not. I mean, you know, who knows? It's certainly they're not speaking to the issue.
Right.
But I hope that the word gets out. I understand you want to ask, the reason that you're there in Crawford, Texas, is because you want to ask a couple of questions of President George W. Bush. What are the questions that you would ask him were you to have an opportunity to sit down and speak with him?
Okay.
Cindy, I'm sorry, your phone is breaking up.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now. Maybe okay. You have to stand in a particular place or something if you're using a cell phone. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I haven't moved the whole interview, so this is really weird. Mm. But I want to ask him, I'm going to call him on some things that he has said. He first, last Wednesday after the Marines were killed, said that their families can rest assured that their sons and daughters died in a noble cause. I want to ask him what the noble cause is, because I don't believe invading a country in a war of aggression, a country that was no threat to the United States of America, and killing innocent people is a noble cause. And if he's going to start, if we get the meeting, which, you know, I really don't think is very likely, but if we get the meeting, and if he starts to say freedom and democracy, I'm going to say, this is over. I'm not going to talk to you until you can talk straight with me. And then, are you still there?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And then I'm going to ask him, if it's such a noble cause, would he be willing to send or encourage Jenna and Barbara to go, since there's soldiers over there that don't want to be there? There's soldiers over there that are on a third tour of duty. There's soldiers over there who have completed their honorable service to the United States of America, and they're being stop-loss and held against their will, and they want to come home. So if, you know, such a noble cause, you put your money where your mouth is and put your own skin in the game. And then the third thing I want to from him is for him to stop saying that we have to finish the mission to honor the sacrifices of the fallen. And number what is wrong about that is the mission is so ill-defined and it changes all the time. Is that mission is never going to be completed in Iraq, because they're building permanent bases the size of Sacramento, California. These people in power plan on never leaving Iraq. And number two about him saying that, I don't want him to use my son's death to justify more killing. Why, as a broken-hearted mom, would I want another mom in any part of the world to go through the same thing that I'm going through? I want him to honor Casey's sacrifices by bringing the troops home.
Yeah, well said. Cindy Sheehan, I'd like to play just a very short clip of the right-wing spin on all this, not specifically on what you're doing, but on anybody who speaks out against the Bush administration's policy. They refer to it as undermining the war on terror. This is Bill O'Reilly speaking about his thoughts on what should be done with and to people who stand up to the president and speak out and undermine, in quotes, the war on terror. Just listen to this short clip, and then I'd like to get your take on it, if you don't mind.
Because you must know the difference between dissent from the Iraq war and a war on terror and undermining it. And any American that undermines that war with our soldiers in the field, or undermines the war on terror with 3,000 dead on 9/11, is a traitor. Everybody got it? Dissent? Fine. Undermining, you're a traitor. Got it? So, all those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains? Because they, you know, they're undermining everything.
So that's the right-wing take on it, Cindy, that you and I should be taken off in chains. Your thoughts?
Well, he's trying to get me to come on his show. I really or not, maybe while I'm there he'll have me arrested or something.
Yeah.
But, you know, people like that who say we don't have the right to do what we're doing, I believe that they're traitors in America. And another thing is that...
Cindy, you're fading out quite badly right now. I'm not able to hear you. Might want to try and move around into a different position. Who knows? We're talking with Cindy Sheehan. We appear to have lost the signal. If you can hear us, Cindy, we're still here. And just, you know, commenting, Cindy saying that she feels that the people who say that we as Americans have no right to speak out, no right to undermine George Bush, that they are the traitors. And I just have to say, Cindy, I absolutely agree with you. That is treason. This is what, you know, what Karl Rove did, what Scooter Libby did, outing a CIA agent. Yeah, okay, that's treason. But speaking out in a way that defies the ideals of our country, that is wrong. That is absolutely wrong. 1-866-889-8894. Kevin in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Kevin, you have some thoughts on this.
Hey, Tom, how are you doing today?
I'm well. We have about a minute, Kevin, before we have to take a break. What's up?
Real quick, as with any president, like, what's this lady's ultimate goal? And, geez, I do sympathize with her. You know, God.
She wants to ask George W. Bush why her son died.
As the commander-in-chief, does any president really have to, stand up and ask, answer questions to any individual soldiers?
The commander-in-chief has to tell the people of the United States why he is sending their citizens to war, yes.
It's pretty well explained.
Yes, he told us that the reason why the soldiers were there was to stop weapons of mass destruction.
Okay.
And there's no weapons of mass destruction, so why are we still there?
So you want to pull out today and just let the pieces fall where they may? Is that your ultimate goal?
Speaking for myself, actually, I think that we have become a part of the problem rather than the cause of the problem. And I think if we were to pull out, that it would actually improve the situation there rather than make the situation worse. I may be wrong on that, and obviously it's not going to happen that way. But, yeah, that's my opinion on it.
But let me ask you this question. Do you think any president, take Bill Clinton, if I wanted to go up and ask Bill Clinton about something, does every citizen in the country have a right to just go up and address the president in a one-on-one meeting?
Well, wouldn't it be nice? I mean, for the first half a dozen presidents, the United States actually used to open the front door of the White House. Thomas Jefferson used to answer people knocked on the front door of the White House, and he would take their calls. But the reality is, obviously, every citizen doesn't have the ability to call upon the president. But I would say Cindy Sheehan is speaking for a lot of people beyond just Cindy Sheehan. She is the co-founder of Gold Star Families for Peace. She is the mother of a child who died in Iraq, a very small and select group of about 1,800 people now. And I think that the president should meet with her, if for nothing else, his own public relations. It's 20 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Let's get it started. Ha! Let's get it started in here. Let's get it started. Ha! Let's get it started.
Reconstituting its nuclear weapons. The evidence indicates that Iraq is reconstituting its nuclear weapons program. Saddam Hussein has held numerous meetings with Iraqi nuclear scientists, a group he calls his nuclear mujahideen, his nuclear holy warriors, facing clear evidence of peril. We cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun, that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 25 minutes past the hour, 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, obviously, what Cindy Sheehan is doing is political theater. And my hope is it will be effective political theater, because this administration has lied us into a war, and they do owe the American people. And I'm viewing Cindy Sheehan as a representative of we, the American people, or a large segment of us. They do owe us an explanation. The polls now show that the vast majority of Americans believe that George Bush has lied to us. And we're over it. It's time for some straight talk, Mr. President. We'd like to know what's really going on. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Ann in Lincoln, Nebraska on the line. Hey, Ann, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. On Cindy Sheehan's, and she was NBC just decided that they weren't going to talk to her. Maybe we should boycott NBC and all their programs, especially the news, and the products they sell.
Well, I would suggest instead that you contact NBC and let them know that you'd like to know what's going on with Cindy Sheehan. Because, you know, that will be, frankly, far more effective than a boycott.
Okay.
And there, if you go to NBC.com, you can find on their website the telephone numbers for them, for their news department, MSNBC as well. In particular, you can look at the individual shows, contact Hardball. She was supposed to be on Hardball. She was supposed to be on the Today Show. You can find each one of those shows' websites. They will give telephone numbers and emails for the executive producer. Contact those producers and say, hey, why are you ignoring Cindy Sheehan? Here is this woman who is the mother of one of our heroes. And why are you dissing her? What's going on here? Why did you schedule her to be on your program and then cancel her? That's what I would do. I think that'll be far more effective than a boycott, which, you know, if you're right, a large organized boycott by many people, but that takes time to organize and you know, be active rather than passive. But I congratulate you, Ann, for thinking about these kinds of things. I mean, this is the kind of conversation we need to be having. Thank you, Ann, very much for the call. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. Matt in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Hey, Matt, welcome to the program.
Oh, hey, Tom. Great show.
Thank you.
Hey, listen, I just wanted to call and comment on the gentleman who called earlier, the Bush supporter.
Yeah.
Well, he didn't proclaim himself as a Bush supporter, but reading between the lines, it sounded like he was. You know, it occurred to me, I mean, we live in a representative democracy here. This man, this president, is supposed to be accountable to us. There's never been a more secretive White House. I mean, this guy has
literally never in history.
This guy has the fewest press conferences. He's the least accountable president we've ever had.
Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, literally, in the history of the United States, we have never had documents being classified secret at the rate they are being classified. We've never had a president who... He has had fewer press conferences, publicly televised press conferences, than since the invention of television or since the invention of radio. So yeah.
This can't go on in a democracy, though. I
agree with you, Matt, and thanks for the comment and for making that, because it renders democracy non-viable when the leaders of the democracy are not responsive to the people. Jay in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Jay, welcome to the program.
Thanks. If I could just make a quick side point before my main remark.
We have about 30 seconds, Jay.
Well, I want Sidney to ask Bush, why didn't you take us to war a week earlier? That would make him have to force the issue. And for you, I want to know, people like Bernie Goldberg would defend what he did by saying that the Germans and the United Nations thought that he had weapons of mass destruction. What would you say to that?
Well, the Germans didn't think he had weapons of mass destruction. That's why they refused to participate. And Resolution 1441 clearly and explicitly said that we could only go to war if Hans Blix or Mohammed al-Baradei found weapons of mass destruction. And this is what Blix had to say.
You know, in the Middle Ages, when people were convinced they were witches, and then they looked for them, they said they found them. And this is a bit risky. I think we were more judicious in saying that we want to have real evidence. And I'm not going to cite what the intelligence agencies are saying unless I have the evidence for it. If I had that, well, then I would do it.
And he never had it. And so we illegally went to war in violation of Resolution 1441. They had to ratify it after the fact. 29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. It's never too late
to start all over again. Tragedy arrived on a quiet morning. September the 11th. Danger. Doom. Danger. Doom. Killers. Be afraid. The world drifts toward tragedy. Tragedy.
And welcome back, my friends.
God. Iraq, Afghanistan, and Iraq. Even darkness. God. The continuing danger of terrorism. Be afraid. September the 11th. Continuing danger. We have fought the terrorists across the earth. Evil God, evil. We are staying on the offensive. Evil God, be afraid. God, striking terrorists abroad, and nothing will hold us back, and we will prevail. And nothing will hold us back. Be afraid. God bless America. Nuclear weapons. Iraq was a gathering threat, and Al-Qaeda was largely unchallenged as it planned attacks. Free Afghanistan, terror, Pakistan, terrorism, Saudi Arabia, Libya, weapons programs. Saddam Hussein.
And welcome back, my friends. 26 minutes before the hour. George W. Bush, a few little clips from his Republican National Committee speech. That was the speech when Cindy Sheehan decided enough is enough. Up to that point, she and her husband had decided they would not speak ill of the president. He actually met with them.
Terrorists. We are defeating the terrorists doing battle in Afghanistan. And
but then George W. Bush, during that speech, talked about the families that he was meeting with, and she realized that it was a political ploy, pure and simple, and that's when she decided, time to speak out. Enough is enough.
Tyranny and terror. 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 The enemy. Terror.
Yes. George W. Bush, 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, Jim in Ashland, Oregon on the line. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hey, Tom. A big supporter of what Cindy Sheehan's doing. I applaud her efforts. My comment today is about Bill O'Reilly, though, and what he said about undermining the war. And why can't we jail and do whatever he wants to do to these other folks? Why can't we do that to people who are undermining the peace and really causing people's lives to be lost?
Well, I just have to say, I think that on behalf of Bill O'Reilly, here's what he would probably say to you.
Well, the shut up line has happened only once in 6 years.
Well, I know what
shut
I'm
up.
Doing.
Shut up.
I'm asking you to shut up about sex.
Quiet! Listen, cut his mic.
No,
hey, shut up!
No,
you had your 35 minutes. Shut up.
And it is our duty as loyal Americans
to shut up and shut up publicly. We expect every American to support our military, and if they can't do that, to shut up. So you keep your mouth shut.
In a democracy, you don't have to shut up. Speak up.
There you go. So.
Yep, I mean, that is what he would say. No doubt about it.
Not just what he would say, it's what he did say.
It is what he did say. Yeah, that's true. I just think it's a shame that we worry so much about undermining the Republicans' view of things, but yet those of us who believe that the real crime is undermining peace and causing the great loss of life, it's like our opinion is worth nothing.
Yeah, well, I think our opinion is increasingly worth something. Our opinion echoes the opinion of George Washington in his farewell address to America, where he said, please avoid foreign entanglements. He warned us against exactly the kind of thing that George Bush has got us into, and we need to be heeding that warning again. Jim, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate
it.
Good to hear from you. Mary in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Mary, welcome to the program.
Hi, dear Tom. I just want to say, first of all, Cindy is a true American hero. I just am behind her 1,000%. My question is, too, why is it, I'm just so baffled to know, why it is that more military families aren't out in mass, just a national outcry. They're the ones whose sons and daughters are being lost every single day in this illegal war.
And, you know, I think part of it, Mary, is that 25 years of Republican economics have led us to the point where one person can no longer support a family.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got people, you know, in 1960, on average, one person could support a family. By 1990, it took 1.2. You know, by 1995, 1.25. By the year 2000, 1.5. I mean, we're up over 1.75 now. This is the result of the economic policies, which I think, in their minds, I think that they wanted to reduce the middle class's political potency by making us, you know, taking us back to Dickensian times. So part of it is that people are just working too hard. Part of it is that our mass media is now concentrated in the hands of about a dozen multinational corporations, many of which are large defense contractors, and you're not hearing the message. You're just, you know, you're not getting it. And part of it is that there hasn't yet emerged a clear rallying point. And I think Cindy has the potential to be that. And so, you know, she's asking people to actually come to Crawford, Texas. You can fly into either Austin or I believe it's Dallas. And it's about an hour and a half drive from there. And come down to Crawford, Texas, and camp out with them. Help them. You know, show up. And, you know, yesterday on this program, she called for that. And I encourage people who want to support her to actually show up. There's also a website, meetwithcindy.org, I believe it is. One of the folks in our chat room had given it to me. Let me just see here if I've got Yeah, meetwithcindy.org. That website seems to be suffering a lot of denial of service attacks, where the right-wingers go in and hit it over and over and over again, try and bring it down. Because from time to time, I've been unable to get into it. But you can check out that website also, meetwithcindy.org.
Okay, so, great.
That's it. Mary, thanks for the call, and thanks for your kind words for Cindy. She needs all of our concern and all of our prayers, frankly,
absolutely,
if I may say so. Mary, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. John in Lake Charles, Louisiana on the line. Hey, John, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hey, how you doing, Tom? First time calling here.
Well, thank you. Thank you for calling.
Yeah. I'm a trucker. I'm over here in Texas right now running back home.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't quite understand, you know, why is the recruiting so low? Didn't he win by 55 million? Why aren't they just, you know, crowding the recruiting stations trying to get in and fight this war? It brought it back so much.
Yeah, why aren't Jenna and Barbara out there?
I mean, they want to fight the war. I mean, they want us to go and fight the war. Why don't they break the doors down? You know, hey, they need some recruits. They need some people.
Yeah, well, see, that's, John, you are the, you're the, you're playing the role of the little boy who said the emperor has no clothes. You realize, because this emperor has no clothes. I'm sorry. This is. First of all, it's not a war. It was an invasion, which was successful, followed by an occupation, which was totally screwed up. And so we don't have a war. We have an occupation. And occupations tend to go this way. And if George Bush had paid attention when he was studying history at Yale University, instead of getting somebody, you know, hiring somebody to write his term papers for him, then he might have realized this. I mean, this is what bled dry the Roman Empire. You read Gibbon's The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. This is what happened to them. And it's happening all over again. John, thanks for your kind comments and for calling in and for listening to the program. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Joy in Santa Cruz, California on the line. Hey, Joy.
Hi, Tom. Look, I just wanted to reiterate to that caller who called in who's criticizing Cindy for doing what she's doing that we elect these people. They work for us, not the other way around. And we have the right to question them when their job performance is down. And she has every right to question.
But Joy, I mean, you know, George Bush would say, sorry.
Either with us or against us. You're either evil or you're good.
Which is it, you know?
Well, it's questionable. Right. Well, it's questionable whether he was elected. But
yeah, I'll give you that.
This guy needs to reread his civics and find out who they work for. They don't, you know, they aren't just selected. Well, he was, but they still are answerable to every single one of us. And we all have the right and the duty and the responsibility to question them when they're doing things that are wrong and when they're endangering our children's lives and endangering our nation. And you know, they're threatening to arrest her as a national security threat. The only national security threat in that area lives in the ranch.
Yeah. When a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. And we can do it in the ballot box the year after next, and we need to get politically active right now. Those are the words of Thomas Jefferson, by the way, of course, from the Declaration of Independence. Joy, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening on KRXA there, right, in Santa Cruz.
Yeah, I think, yeah.
Yep, appreciate it very much. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Tony in Illinois driving a truck. Hey, Tony, what's up? Tony,
yes.
Tony, you're live on the air. You got to listen to the phone instead of the radio.
Yes, I just wanted to say I'm in support of what Cindy's doing. I think that we all should show our support for her by joining her down there in Texas and have us a Texas cookout, so to speak.
I agree.
Let these Nazis realize that, you know, they can't shut us all up. They've got to notice, you know, what she's trying to say and do here.
Yeah, and those people who can't get there, check out your local Veterans for Peace chapter. I know the Veterans for Peace here in Portland, Oregon, today from noon to 1 is having a rally right in front of the federal building in downtown Portland, Oregon. And my guess is that Veterans for Peace groups all around the United States may be doing this. And if not, contact them and say, hey, let's do it, you know, in whatever town that you're in. So Seems like a plan there, Tony. Tony, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Linda in Pittsburgh on the line. Hey, Linda, what's up?
Hi. Boy, it's a pleasure that a Pittsburgh station has you on.
Well, thank you.
And we can listen.
Yes, and thanks to WPTT for carrying the program. What's on your mind, Linda?
I was thinking, and I don't know if this is a good similarity, but do you remember Nixon when he was so upset with Kerry and the all the veterans who might have marched in Washington and tried to stop it?
I'm sorry. Say that again, Linda. I had to deal with a computer thing here for a second. I'm sorry. I missed what you said.
Okay. I was wondering if you remember when Nixon was so upset when if you remember hearing the tapes of Kerry when all the veterans were going to march.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And he was talking with, ultimately, he brought in John, what's his name, the Swiftboat guy.
Exactly. You know,
yeah, to
do
be a hitman.
Do you think, Cindy, is that to George Bush? That...
Oh, no doubt in my mind. No doubt in my mind. She is this generation. She is doing in this generation what Vietnam Veterans Against the War were doing, and John Kerry was leading that for some time there back in the late 60s, early 70s, well, throughout the 70s. Or much of the 70s, early 70s. Yeah, I think that perhaps is one of the reasons why all of a sudden the national media is deciding that they're not going to touch her. I think that they're getting leaned on really hard. You know, the way that this White House controls who gets to say what and who gets to speak out is by saying to folks in the media, saying to the corporations, you know, your reporters will not be able to do their jobs if we don't talk to you, and that we are going to refuse to talk to the reporters who give people like Cindy Sheehan a hearing. I mean, that's how they've done it traditionally. When Helen Thomas, ever since Harry Truman, Helen Thomas always sat in the first row and asked the first question. She asked the first question of George W. Bush in his first press conference. It was a hard question. He moved her to the back of the room. She hasn't been called on since. And she lost her job with the AP as a result of it. That's the kind of hardball these guys play.
Exactly. And, you know, he really doesn't want this kind of attention to come to the war, especially with a mother of a fallen soldier, to say, you know, what are we doing here? What's happening? The same kind of questions they started asking of Vietnam. He doesn't need that attention.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can I ask you one more question?
Sure.
I've been kind of yelling about for a while.
And we might also learn a lot more about how Reagan became president and the whole October surprise thing that we were talking yesterday with Barbara Honegger about. And, I mean, there's a lot that we might have learned that they really don't want us to know, and that's why this is going on. Linda, thanks for the call. I got to move along, but I appreciate it, and thank you. Thank you for listening to us there in Pittsburgh. Jeff in Macon, Georgia on the line. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Hi. I'm a Vietnam veteran. My father was a World War II veteran.
Yeah.
So it really boils down to who wins and who gets to try who for war crimes.
Ultimately, I mean, yes, because war is a pretty horrible business, unfortunately.
And really, if you look at it, I mean, Rumsfeld kind of looks at it as a test of will. The fact of the matter is, during Vietnam, when I was in, the Tet Offensive was a military disaster for the North Viet Cong. They lost 50,000 men.
Yeah.
But it was a huge political victory for them.
Yeah.
And... we're not, the North Vietnamese lost 3 million men out of a population of 22 million.
Yeah, Jeff, we can't refight that war, but I'm agreeing with you. And the point is that we don't even have the military mean. We don't have the army now to do that. And if we did, it would be a Pyrrhic victory. Because we would have to do, as, you know, the old Lieutenant Calley kind of thing, we'd have to destroy the country in order to save it, as it were. Because we have become the irritant against which many of the insurgents are fighting. You've got many of the members, over a third of the members of the elected parliament in Iraq, have already stood up and asked us to leave. The elected prime minister of Iraq has asked us to leave, has asked us to set a timetable. I think that we are the problem, not the solution. I'm there with you. Mary Ellen in Brentwood, California. Hey, Mary Ellen, we got about a half a minute here left. What's up?
Oh, fine. Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I was just in business in Texas. I normally live out in Northern California, happen to be in Texas listening to the show, and I just want to let you know that I'm headed toward Crawford, Texas right now.
Good on you.
So much support.
That's wonderful. Good on you. Congratulations. That is marvelous.
Thank you. Thank you.
I am so pleased to hear that you're doing that. You're our jolly good fellow. Or or fella or fella. What, I don't know if there's a feminine version of fellow, but anyhow, thanks a lot, Mary Ellen.
Oh, sure. Thank you.
Great to hear from you, and good on you. That's Cindy Sheehan needs all the help she can get. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. We'll be back with your calls and more after this break. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, exposing the con and conservative, 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Third time I've said that. I'll probably say it three more times. See, in my line of work, you got to keep repeating things over and over and over again for the truth to sink in, to kind of catapult the propaganda.
You gave them the old razzle-dazzle. You razzle-dazzled them.
Oh, George, you did so good.
You gave them an act with lots of flash in it. Made them believe you were compassionate. Gave them the old hocus-pocus. You misdirected them with 9/11 and Saddam Hussein. You played them both right to perfection, despite the fact there's no connection. You razzle-dazzled them, let those blue states complain.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 1-866-889-8894. We've got quite a few callers and just about 2.5 minutes here to go, so please keep it short. Donna, Houston, Texas. What's up, Donna?
Hi, Tom. Just wanted to let you know that I called the NBC station locally in Houston.
Hey, good on you.
They said that their phone lines have been jammed with this story, and they're going to send TV cameras out, so I'll watch the news tonight to see. In the meantime, I've called my kids, and their kids are calling their friends, and they're going to be a lot more phone calls.
That's what it takes.
Thanks for spreading the word. We're hoping maybe we can get somebody to pay some attention to her.
That's great. Thank you so much, Donna.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you. By the way, Scott mentioned a lot of folks, Scott, who's answering our phones here, Scott Forrester, mentioned that a lot of folks have called and asked, you know, can I donate frequent flyer miles, money, how can I help? Gold Star Families for Peace, gsfp.org is Cindy's website, plus meetwithcindy.org, the two websites that are associated with that. I'm not sure that they're set up to take any kind of in-kind contributions or others, but those are the numbers. Jerry in Brothersfordton, North Carolina. Hey, Jerry.
I've got three words for the national media.
Okay.
You are cowards.
There you go. I don't disagree with you at all. Dennis by truck in Texas. Hey, Dennis.
Hi. I think that it would be real easy for someone locally or for the president's people to be jamming her cell phone.
Yeah, that wouldn't. I kept thinking the same thing when she was trying to talk to me, Dennis, and it wouldn't surprise me. Bob in Dallas. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hello?
Yeah, you got a few seconds here, Bob.
Hey, Tom. Listen, they're trying to swift vote her like they did Kerry.
Oh, I know. Over on Drudge, they're sliming her.
Anything has to do with the military, they're doing the swift vote thing. And I think they're going to lose their military vote.
I think they already have, Bob. I think they already have. In fact, the only military vote that we know from the 2004 election was one county in North Carolina. It went overwhelmingly for John Kerry. They managed to suppress all of the rest of the military vote. Typically, you know how the military voted. This time, 2004, we don't have an idea. And I can tell you why. Because the military is not voting for George W. Bush.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast, border to border. Our program, the center of the vast radical middle conspiracy, take no imitations. Our phone number, 1-866-889-8894. 8894. We've had Evan Sayat on a few times on the program. I wanted to bring him back. Evan, I call him the author of the Right Wing Talking Points. But Evan, you and welcome to the program, Evan.
Thanks, Tom.
EvanSayett .com, your website.
May be, but that's not mine. There's only one T in my last name.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I've got a typo.
My only concern is that could be a porn site, and then, you know.
Yeah, like WhiteHouse.com.
Exactly.
Okay. You wrote a piece here on embryonic stem cells, and I'd like to discuss that with you in the 20 minutes or so that we're gonna have to talk here. But I came to a sentence in this, and it really struck me that this is where it breaks down. And you said, I've come to realize, to recognize the Democrats as a party of liars. It should not be surprising that to people who, to whom life means nothing, truth means even less. I simply do not take anything the Democrats say at face value anymore. And I just have to say, Evan, I think that anytime either one of us, me speaking of Republicans, you speaking of Democrats, paint the other with that broad a brush, as if to say all Democrats are evil, or my saying all Republicans are evil, that we're actually harming this nation.
You know, I would agree with you, and I was aware that that would probably be what we'd talk about today. And I don't paint all Democrats. It's the party leadership that is in question to me. And it's absolutely a disservice that we've come to a point in our country where there's such distrust for the other side. And something's got to be done about it, but those are my feelings. I mean, I just don't think that somebody who will stand and yell Bush is Hitler at a time of war or attack our troops as being like the Nazis, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, is somebody whom I can have a goodwill conversation with.
You're talking about Harry Reid.
No, I'm talking about, I listed them in the piece who they were, whether it's Howard Dean, the head of the party, who is disingenuous, and that's being kind at this point, whether it's Ted Kennedy, you know, having to go to Guantanamo Bay and to be told by the troops there, stop slandering us. You know, it's just, I find it far more from the Democratic Party.
Yeah, and I'm, you know, and I have a lot of problems with the Republican Party. And again, I think that the extent to which we broad brush and create these straw men in our arguments and then try and knock them down, I really don't think it's serving good discourse. Let's talk specifically about stem cell research. You're suggesting that, I'm assuming, based on your piece here, when I kind of try and filter out of it the hyperbole, and I don't mean that in a way to slap you, because you know sometimes we both engage in hyperbole to make a point. But you know when I filter it down, it seems like what you're saying is that you're agreeing with George Bush's position that the federal government should not be funding embryonic stem cell research. Am I getting that correct?
I'm thinking that this is an issue in which, you know, I've mentioned this to you before, and I'm actually pro-choice. As far as the abortion issue goes, I just don't think that's being offered by either side. In fact, I'm much closer to the Republican position, which is that the state should decide, that children should have to talk to their parents before they have operations performed on them, et cetera, et cetera. This is even a tougher one because it's not as fully developed a life and whatnot. But what we need in this country is an honest debate about whether we want to cross this line. It's a Rubicon. You know, it's a line of where we are creating the stuff of human life for business purposes, for personal use by others. And I don't think that we're at a place in this country right now where we can have a fair debate between people of goodwill.
Well, first of all, I would suggest that the debate about when human life is viable, really, that debate was kind of wrapped up in 1973 with Roe v. Wade, where they said, by the end of the first trimester, prior to the end of the first trimester, it's between a woman and a doctor. And
okay,
after the first trimester, then the state can get involved, and the individual states can pass laws that regulate the second and third trimester. I mean, that's right there in the Roe v. Wade decision.
But where we are right now is that we have entered that slippery slope.
Right. Well, people want to revisit that. Excuse me. You want to finish your thought?
Uh-huh. You know, they're just that we've entered this conversation before where there was a reasonable compromise to be made amongst people who disagreed. I mean, I respect human life at any form, but I recognize that it's not my place in a democracy to make my feelings the law. But we had a decent compromise in that it was the first trimester and that abortions would be discouraged. And we're at a place now where Planned Parenthood sells T-shirts that say, I had an abortion. And there's no respect for the human life as opposed to the sense of, okay, this is unfortunate.
Well, again,
so we have to accept it.
Evan, I'd say that you're exaggerating, and I don't think that it serves this discussion. Let's talk specifically about, you know, and creating evil people out there, Planned Parenthood, all those awful people. Planned Parenthood does a lot of good in the world.
Of course they do a lot of good, but they also do a lot of bad.
Unfortunately, we've
entered a period of time now where children aren't old enough to decide what sodas to drink on campuses, but they can go have an abortion at 12 years old. And that's not the slippery slope I want to go down with on stem cell research again.
Okay, well, let's bring it back to stem cells then. Here you have the way that we end up with these embryos that are being used for stem cell research is we have across the United States hundreds of thousands, probably millions of women who at some point in their young lives got an infection, usually a chlamydial infection, that got up into their fallopian tubes, left them filled with scar tissue, and so when the ovaries release the egg can't stick in the fallopian tubes, which is where fertilization actually occurs. It doesn't occur in the uterus, and therefore they can't get pregnant. So what they do is they take a whole bunch of those eggs out of the ovaries, put them in a petri dish, take some sperm from their husband, mix them together, a whole bunch of them get fertilized. They look at them very carefully with a microscope, say, okay, out of the 10, 20, 30, 50, 100 of them here, this one looks like a good healthy one. Pull that one out. They implant it in the womb, in other words, bypassing the fallopian tubes, and that woman then goes to term and has a pregnancy. When you're done with that, you have a whole bunch of fertilized embryos that are then flushed down the sink. And literally hundreds of thousands of these are flushed down the sink every year in the United States. Now, you're suggesting that instead of flushing them down the sink, we should do what? Have funerals for them?
I'm just saying that when we start to get to the point where that's not significant, that's not enough to accomplish what we're seeking to accomplish, and that these things...
But that's a huge number of them. Nobody is suggesting that embryos be fertilized for medical research. Nobody. Nobody. I mean, that's a straw man argument. There are so many extra embryos out there from in vitro fertilization clinics, hundreds of thousands of them over the years.
And nobody was arguing, Tom, that children should be allowed to go out and have abortions at 12 years old, because what the heck? It's not really a life yet. You know, this is just a conversation that I hate this argument because it's so against what I truly... I fight against the slippery slope argument. But we've been down this road before.
So you're saying it's all or nothing. You can't have anything in between because then it is a slippery slope.
Well, here's my question for you, okay? And let me answer that, by the way. It's not all or nothing. And in fact, I think that my stem cell... I know that my stem cell argument was really more of a plea to the Democrats to come through with reasonable arguments instead of personal attacks and attacking people as being religious fanatics if they have concern. It was much more of a plea, as I wrote in the thing, this is an issue that I'm not settled on, and I really was begging more for a conversation like the one we're beginning to have here than I was saying what my position is on this, because I'm torn. How can you not be torn when the opportunity is to give a full life to people whose parents love them and whose children adore them and need them and whatnot, and to people who are suffering? So I don't know my position on this one. I know I'm not. That doesn't make me the right wing talking point guy.
I mean, yeah. Here's the problem, Evan. If you look to the Bible, which some folks are suggesting we should do, mm-hmm. life begins when a baby takes its first breath. That's what the Bible says. It says
okay.
When the first breath, it's called the breath of life. When that
now,
first
wait,
breath,
here's how it really works, Tom. Each religion has a different standard. I believe, and I could be wrong because I'm not a theologian, life begins, according to the Catholics, at conception.
That's where I was going with that.
According to the Protestants,
that's a recent thing. That's only in the last 50 or 60 years.
Okay. Well, yeah. I was actually going to try to make a joke there, believe
okay.
it or not.
Okay, well, go for it. That's what you do for a living. Go for it. I'm sorry.
And Protestants, it's, I believe, at birth when it takes its first breath. And Jews, it's when it enters medical school.
Oh, you speak,
all right, sorry.
And you're speaking, you're
You
Jewish.
Were being serious. I'm
right.
just trying to bring it back for
okay.
a moment.
All right. Yeah, I appreciate the attempt at humor. It's,
okay.
You know, and in fact, you're doing a humor thing here coming up, aren't you? A Friars Club thing?
That's the perfect segue.
Yeah.
At the Friars of Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
Beverly Hills, California, tonight of conservative comedians. The charity is the Freedom Alliance Scholarship Fund, which sends the kids of soldiers killed in Iraq and Afghanistan to college. It's a good cause. It's a good place. And I'm a great comedian. So if you're within the sound of my voice, no, that's not good. If you're in the Los Angeles area, please come see it.
Okay.
Thanks, Tom.
Now, I have to say, Evan, I have never, ever met anybody who is pro-abortion.
I disagree with you.
Well, you can disagree with me, but I'm telling you my personal experience. I've been on this planet 54 years, and I have never met somebody who's pro-abortion.
But you're not going to say I'm pro-abortion, but on the other hand, you're going to forward policies that advance abortion, and often by being dishonest, by only telling half a story, by implying that abortions are easy and perfectly safe with no side effects.
I don't know anybody who's suggesting that, Evan.
Some people even sell T-shirts that proudly proclaim I had an abortion, like it's a fun night, like a Green Day concert.
You know, again, I think that you're creating straw man arguments. You're taking, I have no idea about the T-shirts. I'd be amazed if anybody's selling a T-shirt like that. If it happens,
Planned
it's a terrible
Parenthood.
Thing.
Okay, I'll send you the link.
That's I think it's a shame. But the reality is that you're taking a small point and just really blowing it out. The reality is this has got to be a very, very difficult thing. Don't you think it's a little weird that here we are, two guys who are never going to have an abortion, who can never even imagine what it would like to become pregnant. We're never going to have to worry about what might happen if we're raped. We're never going to, two guys are having a discussion about whether women should be allowed to have abortions.
Well, no, I don't find that odd at all. I mean, first of all, I don't divide people up into, I'm not a human because I'm not a woman. I mean, we share a lot of things. A woman and I share a lot of things. And, you know, the idea.
You don't share the ability to get pregnant.
No, but on the one hand, the idea that if I impregnate somebody, I am financially responsible for that person their whole lives. But if she decides to kill it, I have no say in it. That's playing both sides of the fence.
Well,
you know,
and again,
that it's the woman who has to make this decision.
Yeah, and I think it should be. Although I think that, you know, in most families, it's a decision presumed, you know, hopefully most functional families, it would be a very difficult and agonizing decision that would be made by a husband and wife if that's the situation. But the reality is that, you know, very often it's not. It's the woman's body that's at risk. Evan,
no,
it's the
baby's body.
Yeah, well, no, it's not a baby yet, see. We're talking a fetus.
I know you want to run. Do I have a second?
No, well, yeah, 5 seconds.
Well, okay. Well, you know what? I'm not coming back. We'll talk when we come back.
Yeah, no, we're not. We're wrapping this segment.
All right, we'll do it next time then.
Okay. Good talking with you, Evan. EvanSayet.com. Evan, say it. Hey, Evan, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 25 minutes past the hour, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Found an interesting, actually one of the folks in our chat room pointed me to it, an interesting discussion about the debate within Planned Parenthood about that T-shirt that Evan was talking about. It's actually a very thoughtful one, and I'll share it with you after this segment. But first, I want to hear from Ellen Ratner in Washington, D.C., find out what's going on. Ellen, our Washington, D.C. bureau chief. Hey, Ellen.
Hi. Well, it's very interesting. I think I told you on your local show this morning about Representative Kurt Weldon from Pennsylvania and how he basically, he's written a book called Countdown to Terror, the top secret information that could prevent the next nuclear, next terrorist attack on America, and how the CIA has ignored it. He's the one that came out and said that the CIA also had these classified documents before 9/11. I'm actually going to be interviewing him a little later.
Kurt Weldon, he's a Democrat, is he not?
I believe he's a Republican.
He's a Republican?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Talk about cracks.
A mad Republican.
Talk about cracks in the wall.
Yeah. So I'm going to be interviewing him this afternoon. I'll send you the sound on that. That should be pretty interesting. Meanwhile, the president has been having his economic growth meeting today.
Mm-hmm.
And he has been talking about how he wants to make tax cuts permanent. This is what the White House is putting out. They want to restrain spending by the federal government. This unnecessary regulation, you know what that means.
Yeah.
They said they want to, now it's called, instead of Social Security, strengthening retirement security. Reform the tax code, and I don't know if I told you, but the tax panel looks like it's looking into a consumption tax. Protecting small business owners from frivolous lawsuits. Reforming immigration laws. And making health care more affordable. That's what his big goals are.
And I'm guessing at each one of the levels of this, this means more for the wealthy and less for the middle class. I mean, the bottom line, consumption taxes hit the middle class.
Of course, and the working class.
Yeah, yeah. I'm using the terms actually kind of interchangeably. But yes, absolutely. Oh, my goodness. And so do you think that he has enough political capital left to pull any of this off? It seems to me that he's just sinking like a stone.
I wish I could say he was sinking like a stone, but I do think he actually has enough political capital not to pull out the Social Security thing, certainly to get some of the legal reforms that he wants so there won't be, quote-unquote, frivolous lawsuits. I actually do think he has the political capital for that.
Hmm. Wow.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah, and in fact, the asbestos bunch is, you know, he's big on that with the so-called frivolous asbestos lawsuits for, you know, people who have been harmed by that.
Well, the asbestos lawsuits, you know, they have been going back and forth and back and forth in Congress on that, and they just, it's also not totally party-oriented because a lot of people have districts where there have been heavy-duty asbestos usage, and so there are some Republicans that are very much on the president's tail on that one.
Yeah, this is Bush on that topic.
And our economy is held back by irresponsible class actions and frivolous asbestos claims.
That's just so much hooey. it's so much nonsense. I mean, my father is a victim of that asbestos, and the extent to which it's holding back the economy. It's holding back the economy because the asbestos is killing people.
Right.
But, yeah, I mean, just for Bush to say, oh, and therefore we've got to give Halliburton, which bought Dresser Industries under Dick Cheney and ended up with this huge asbestos bill, we've got to give Halliburton a pass, which is really the bottom line here. It's wrong. It's criminal. It's absolutely wrong. So, anything, we talked with Cindy Sheehan a little earlier. Do you think she's going to get arrested?
I think it would be very bad for them to arrest her. On the other hand, he may be picking up some points. Some of the Republican hosts I'm on with are like, you know, doing their bidding. So, you know, this may be a way of throwing some red meat to their base again.
Trying to vilify her. Okay.
Right.
Ellen, can you hold the line for just a minute?
Sure.
Stick around for a minute. I need to talk to you offline. It's 29 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. You're in the middle of the real free speech zone. No pass from the RNC required. No barbed wire here.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends. Ambassador to England, a friend. You may like the gamble. Who are you going to serve? You going to serve the Bush administration?
You may be the heavyweight champion of the world. You may be a socialite with a long string of pearls, but you're going to have to serve some.
Or are you going to serve democracy? You're going to serve the interests of the people. You're going to serve the interests of the elite. That's really what it boils down to. You know, the heads of big multinational corporations, their interests were the interests of all of us. I just wanted to share with you this quick piece. This is from Planned Parenthood, their magazine, Choice Magazine. One T-shirt does not an organization make. It's a year ago that this debate happened. And this piece was originally published in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. It's by Leola Rice. She says, since Planned Parenthood Federation in New York began selling a T-shirt on its website with the message, I had an abortion, a number of weeks ago, Planned Parenthood has taken it on the chin from everyone, including Cynthia Tucker at the Atlanta Constitution Journal. And so the Georgia affiliate wants to weigh in on this. They said the T-shirt was designed by Manifesto co-author Jennifer Baumgartner and is designed to challenge the taboo promoted by the anti-choice movement that seeks to cloak discussions of abortion in shame. We understand, they say, some people would have a different judgment about offering this T-shirt for sale, and to be sure, very few affiliates across the country chose to do so. They said, we understand the T-shirt sparks difficult conversations. But that discomfort pales in comparison to what will face us if we shrink from that conversation at this critical time in our nation's history. Women's access to all forms of reproductive health care, including abortion, is being increasingly eroded by the same anti-choice forces who have never worked harder to shame women into silence about the realities of their lives. They go on to add, 1 in 3 women will have an abortion by the time they're 45. Women who have abortions are the same women who have children, and they often make both these decisions with thought and heart and moral deliberation. Further, every woman has the right to decide whether or how to share her experience. For some women, abortion is a private matter they wish to keep private. Others want to share their experience to let other women know there's nothing shameful about making that choice. Still, others may wish for an opportunity to support honest discourse in a visible way. Speaking for Planned Parenthood, they say Planned Parenthood believes every pregnancy should be a wanted pregnancy and every child a wanted child. In every situation, it is the woman, in consultation with her family, her doctor, and her conscience, who is best equipped to make this most private, personal decision. And, one T-shirt does not an organization make, and focusing on the T-shirt results in a total misrepresentation of Planned Parenthood, which is, of course, what the right-wingers are all about. As I was pointing out to Evan, maybe we can get him to stop doing that. I don't know. We'll see. For 40 years in Atlanta and nearly 90 years nationwide, Planned Parenthood has worked to provide education and contraception to help prevent unintended pregnancies and the need for abortion, to help prevent the need for abortion. In Georgia, they say, we provide these along with cancer screenings and sexually transmitted disease testing for over 19,000 women and men. Nearly 73% of all their clients between the ages of 18 and 29, a group at greatest risk for that. And then they go on and talk about their prevention strategies and all that sort of thing. It's a thoughtful piece. And thinking back on the conversation, yeah, the context in which Evan was presenting that information was part of an attempt, I would say, to shame women into, to cloak abortion in the context of shame. And it shouldn't be, in my opinion. It's a difficult decision, but it's not a decision that should have the moral judgment that's associated with shame associated with it. Just speaking for myself. And as I said, as a man, I don't think I have a right to even, I have a right to an opinion as a human being, right? But I don't think that men should be the ones voting on this issue. Gene in Hillsboro, Oregon on the line. Change the subject. Let's get back to Cindy Sheehan here and the struggle that she's facing. Hey, Gene, welcome to the program.
Quick comment. You said for us that it would be a good idea if we emailed NBC and them. And I was thinking, why not just call Current TV and have them put something on their broadcast?
I recommend, in addition to emailing the networks and your local TV and radio stations, that you call them. Calling is actually probably going to be as effective or more effective than emailing. It's going to depend on the institution. I mean, some of the very large institutions, like the big networks, if you call them, you're going to get to a switchboard, and it's never going to go beyond that. If you can get a hold of the email of an actual producer, and whose phone number is probably not listed, and send an email to that producer, you may actually have a chance of being heard by the producer, even if you don't get a response. A lot of these people actually do read their email, or they have a person in their staff who reads their email. So am I speaking to your point? I'm not sure I totally understood it.
Well, what I was saying was, because Current TV is supposed to have that that online thing where the people that that watch the show also kind of program content, just to kind of make sure that they would have there'd be somebody out there that would cover it, and they would kind of have to cover it.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. We need to be putting pressure on the media, on local media, on national media, to say this is a real issue. You know, what Cindy Sheehan is doing, she is speaking not just on behalf of a few people, not just on behalf of a few hundred or a few thousand families who lost their loved ones in Iraq, or the tens of thousands of families whose loved ones have been so badly wounded that their lives are changed forever as a result of Iraq, but also on behalf of those of us who empathize with them, those of us who said out loud, very loudly, very strongly to George W. Bush before he went into this ill-gotten, ill-conceived war, this is going to be a disaster. disaster for the United States. And sure enough, here we are. It's a disaster for the United States. I'm increasingly starting to think we have the Manchurian candidate here, that these guys simply set out to destroy the United States of America, and they're doing it.
Yeah, they are.
Step by step. Gene, thanks for the call. It's good to hear from you. I appreciate it, and thanks for listening to the program there. Condi Rice. The Iraqi insurgency is getting stronger, says the headline. This in the New York Times. The report noted the growing sophistication of the insurgency. This was in Science Daily, actually. U.S. commanders said the number of attacks against American and Iraqi forces has held steady over the last year, averaging about 65 a day, but they concede the growing sophistication of guerrilla attacks and the insurgents' ability to replenish their ranks as fast as they are killed. A senior Army intelligence officer said, "We are capturing or killing a lot of insurgents, but they're being replaced quicker than we can interdict their operations. There's always another insurgent ready to step up and take charge." Now, I would add to that, we are capturing or killing a lot of insurgents. It's not that they're being replaced. It's that our behavior, our action, is causing Iraqi citizens who might have traditionally, normally said, "Hey, I don't have a dog in this fight," you know, to become insurgents. Because for every person in Iraq that we kill, or that we insult, or whose home we trash, or whose child we drag off to prison and electrocute or torture or just even hold and eventually release, for every person in that situation in Iraq, there is an extended family. There is a mother and a father and a child and a daughter or a son or a cousin or a nephew or a brother or a sister or a niece on it goes. I mean, the extended family, particularly in the Middle East, the extended families are much more intact than they are here in the United States. And family and that whole sense of tribe and family, extraordinary, powerful stuff. And it's not that the insurgents are being replaced. It's that we're creating them. There had never been a suicide bombing in the history of the country of Iraq before we showed up. It's not that we went in like flypaper and the terrorists from all over the world suddenly started showing up. Yeah, there is a few who have come into the country. The best estimates I've seen out of the U.S. military is maybe 1,000. But that's a whole different thing from the it must be millions of people in Iraq who are in support of the insurgency, because without that support, without that passive support, the thousands, the tens of thousands, the perhaps hundreds of thousands of actual insurgents, people actually willing to engage our troops in combat, could not survive. You can't have an insurgency without the support of the population, of the populace. You just can't do it. So anyhow, this happens, and this report comes out, and Condoleezza Rice says to Time magazine that she believes the insurgents are losing steam as a political force, even though their ability to kill and maim at will remains undiminished. When Rice points to rather quiet political progress while the country remains embroiled in chaos, even some of her backers cringe. This from Time magazine. Says a Republican elder statesman, "I don't have any sense of where she thinks she's going in Iraq." How do you know you're winning, first of all? We have heard from Rumsfeld and from the Bush administration that we know we're winning because they're killing more of us. Remember, this was Dick Cheney's point? It's the last gasp of the insurgency. The proof that it's the last gasp of the insurgency is that they're killing more of our people. That means that it's the death throes, you know, the thrashing around just before death. Okay, if that's how you know when you're winning, how do you know when you're losing? Would we be losing if all of a sudden they weren't fighting us at all? I mean, if you follow Cheney's logic, that would be the case. How do you know when you're losing? Perhaps you know when you're losing when Newsweek does a poll here in the United States and finds that only 34% of Americans think that that what we're doing is the right thing. Only 34% approve of the way Bush is handling the war in Iraq. Could have something to do with it. I think so. I think this is, you know, very, very, very a significant issue, shall we say. August 3rd, 2005 is the fifth anniversary of George W. Bush's promise to uphold the honor and dignity of the office of President of the United States. This, of course, the office of President of the United States, the office that has the senior administration official in it, who created treason, who, you know, until it kind of came out, we weren't really sure who this person might be.
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Yeah, well, Joe Wilson had an idea, and...
At the end of the day, it's of keen interest to me to see whether or not we can get Karl Rove frog marched out of the White House in handcuffs.
Yeah, so, you know, Joe Wilson thought he had an idea on that. Well, there has been a contest. It is the Karl Rove whack-a-mole contest. And I kid you not, perspectives.com, the blog, the whack-a-mole contest. And Perspectives January 2005, name that Bush scandal contest as well, but perspectives.com, this is where this thing came from. And some great entries, and they have finally given a winner. The winner gets a 1 gigabyte Apple iPod, the Apple iPod Shuffle, and the winning entry, first place, on the Karl Rove whack-a-mole contest, what should be the sentence that Karl Rove gets for committing treason against the United States of America? How should he be punished for this? And the winning entry, revoke Karl Rove's health insurance. Whenever he gets sick, he has to send a videotape to Bill Frist for a public diagnosis. Pretty good, huh? Second place in the frog, you know, the Karl Rove whack-a-mole contest. My suggestion, second place winner, was my suggestion is that we strip Karl Rove naked, give Private Lindy England, a leash, and see what happens next. And the third place winner is Michelle in the Whack-A-Mole Home Edition contest, or the Whack-A-Mole, Karl Rove Whack-A-Mole contest. She won the home edition of Whack-A-Mole. And her suggestion, I hereby sentence Karl Rove to reenact the Ned Beatty scene from Deliverance on the Capitol steps, reporters and sightseers welcome. I guess you would have had to see Deliverance to get that. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Tomas in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Tomas, what's on your mind?
You know, well, first of all, hello.
Hi.
And you said something about an insurgency cannot succeed unless it has support of the people. I would like...
A certain threshold of the people, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, it doesn't say that the people necessarily want to support the insurgency, okay? It just says they support the insurgency. There could be reasons for the people supporting the insurgency. If we go straight to Iraq today, if you have these people coming over from the border of Syria, you know, and they have guns and they take over the town, then you know what? The people are supporting the insurgency because they don't want to die.
But what you're describing, Tomas, is not what's happened. There are no Syrians who have taken over any towns in Iraq.
Well, no, I don't.
These are Iraqis.
The town of Hit and the town of Hadassah, they were taken over by insurgents coming across the border from Syria, and the Marines had to go in there. And we're playing Vietnam again because we're not doing anything against these sanctuaries that the enemy has. And, you know, as a conservative, of course, I get crucified any time I say the word Vietnam, but you got to say what you got to say, you know?
Yeah, you make a point, Tomas, but the reality is that if we weren't there, there would be no insurgency.
Well, if we weren't there...
Because they're, by definition, they're being insurgent against us. They're trying to throw us out.
I mean, I hear this all the time from the brothers on your side of the street there, you know? And... it's like, you know, in World War II, you know, after Pearl Harbor, somebody would have said, okay, look, they killed 3,000 Americans, but hey,
Think of all the millions of people who are going to die if we go to war. Let's just talk about this, because war is going to cause all kinds of insurgencies and wars and killings.
You know, Tomas, in Pearl Harbor, the Japanese hit us. Saddam Hussein never attacked us.
You just can't
make that analogy. I'm sorry. Because Saddam Hussein never attacked us. He had a balsa wood airplane sitting there that was Uday's toy that George Bush said they were going to spray chemical weapons on us with, but that was a joke. I mean, he not only didn't attack us, he couldn't attack us. But Tomas,
well,
good try. I appreciate the you taking a shot at it. We got to run. It's 10 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
So long, honey dear, where I'm bound, I can't tell. Goodbye is too good a word, babe, so I just say fairly well.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. I'm in our chat room. We're getting updates here. This from a new Hartman listener, one of our members in our chat room, nice name. In any case, points out, okay, the campers have announced that there will be 1,000 crosses erected in the ditches near the campground tomorrow. I'm assuming this is the campground where Cindy Sheehan is camped out. The crosses have been ordered, and a truck left this morning for 24-hour delivery. The crosses are being provided by the Veterans for Peace group out of Louisiana. They said that we are looking for volunteers to help put them in, noted Wilson, explaining that law enforcement personnel might be standing behind them, pulling them out as fast as they are erected. He goes on to say, a Secret Service agent showed up a little while ago and was talking to some members of Code Pink. He was wearing blue jeans and a windbreaker when the documentarian from Germany pointed her camera at him from about 50 yards away. He positioned his face away from the camera. Although unconfirmed, the campers said that a couple of farmers came by earlier, and one said, you've made your point, why don't you leave? And note was made that there is some talk about the entire entire road being closed if the campers don't leave, which would make it difficult for the farmers to have access to their property from the road. Sheehan and about six others spent the night in their tents. Somebody brought a pavilion tent and placed it over the sleeping tents. Otherwise, they said they would have slept in the rain. So, I may be doing Randy Rhodes' show this afternoon. It turns out Randy is feeling better, and she's going to be doing her own show, which is great because I can go home and sleep, and I'm glad. And even more important than that, I'm glad to know that Randy's feeling better. So we will carry on. I got an email here while we were on the air from a listener in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Rachel. She says, I'm one of those people who's also torn about this issue. We're talking about the abortion. I had an abortion T-shirt. And I'm uncomfortable with the ads in The Nation and other magazines showing Gloria Steinem and eight other women wearing T-shirts that say, I had an abortion. Here's my take on this. Conversations about abortions have become so loud and abstract that we tend to forget that abortions happen because real human beings have real problems, which the general public may or may not understand and don't have the right to solve for me without my input. The ad, as uncomfortable as it may be, puts a human face back on this. I agree with you, Rachel. She says, I'm a longtime supporter of Planned Parenthood, and they have never tried to get me to buy T-shirts. I suspect this is just from the ad. Could be wrong, though. No, I suspect you're right. And that Evan and the folks on the right are demagoguing the issue. Surprise, surprise. Unfortunately, tragically, for the cause of rational discourse in America. And even occasionally irrational. It's the Tom Hartman radio program where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, the website. As Washington shuts down for August, notes the New York Times today, article by Andrew Kohut and Peter Hoy. As Washington shuts down for August, President Bush's report card from the public for the first half year of his second term is not particularly good. Compared with Reagan and Clinton at a similar point in time, only Nixon, who had by then begun to tumble into the abyss of Watergate, had a lower presidential approval rating. Unlike Nixon's precipitous decline over one mega problem, Mr. Bush's fall in public esteem reflects discontent in a number of areas. People are concerned about the economy. They're concerned about the war in Iraq, his intervention in Terry Schiavo's case, all the partisanship, the fact that he's a horrible divider rather than a uniter. Generally, by and large, people are not happy. And you look at this public opinion poll. This is fascinating. At this point in time, these are four presidents who had two-year terms, more or less. I mean, Nixon's was truncated, but at this point in the presidency, he was still into the second year of his second four-year term. In July of 1973, you had Reagan with a 60%. In July of 1985, you had Reagan with a 60% approval rating, Clinton with a 59% approval rating, Bush with a 44% approval rating. The only one that was worse was Nixon with 39, and that was as Watergate was starting to explode around him, and thus the problem. So, interesting times. Interesting times coming up for Mr. Bush. Greg Mitchell is with us. Greg Mitchell is the editor and publisher and former editor of Nuclear Times. He's also the co-author of Hiroshima in America and was advisor to the award-winning film Original Child Bomb, which will be aired on the Sundance Channel on August 6th. Actually, that would be aired on the Sundance Channel, right, Greg?
Right, but it's repeated all week.
Oh, okay, great. Great. And in this piece that you wrote in the award-winning film and you know, in your work in general, one of the things that you seem to be pointing out is that we really didn't know what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki for 25 years.
Well, we knew we obviously knew the cities had been destroyed or partly destroyed. We knew something bad happened there, no question about it. But images of film images, all film images, were kept from the American public because of the suppression of them by the government and by the military. So all the footage that was shot after the bombings, which showed the effects on human beings, people grew up in the 50s and 60s and certainly saw black and white photographs of the landscape with the buildings flattened. But the photos of what actually happened to the people and the bizarre radiation effects and the true horror of the bombings was kept from the people for literally for decades.
How is that any different from what's happening right now in Iraq, where we don't see the pictures of the children that are being born with cancers and tumors and birth defects from depleted uranium? We're not seeing the pictures of people who are injured in war, our soldiers or people on the other side. We're not
right.
Seeing dead bodies. How is it different?
Well, we at Editor Publisher, our website recently, we did a whole feature on this very, very issue. It's partly self-censorship. The media and newspapers are reluctant to show it. They think it's maybe in bad taste or we'll get people all up in arms showing these kind of things.
But if reality is horrific, shouldn't we be horrified?
Well, that's the point. We've done countless stories and columns about the interviewing the Baghdad reporters and people who've covered the war, many of whom have done some terrific coverage, and ask them, do you think that the American public is getting a true picture of the war? And most of them will say no. They're getting some picture, but they're not getting the true picture, partly because of the newspapers and TV are sort of afraid to show those images, and also partly because they're not allowed to get to the scene, or they're told it's too much violence to really get to the scene of a lot of this. So the combined picture is very murky, and so it's a real problem.
Is it possible, you write that one of the reasons why the images of Hiroshima and Nagasaki were not shown for 25 years, was that the Air Force, many of the senior officials in the Air Force actually felt ashamed of what they did. Many people in the Atomic Energy Administration or their early AEC who helped develop the bomb felt badly about what they did. And, you know, there was just this pervasive sense of moral shame at the highest levels. Number one, could it be that that same thing is happening right now in Iraq, that there are many people in the military who sort of the Colin Powell, you know, you broke it, you own it. These are real people. This is a real war. I don't think that any of the chicken hawks in the Bush administration really get what happens in war. They've never had the experience of it. Could it be that, again, that there's a parallel there? And secondly, when did that story start changing in America? Because I think the primary myth right now in America, the primary story right now in America, is that we had to use the atomic bombs, that had we not, we would have lost at least 1 million soldiers because the Japanese were such ferocious fighters.
Right.
Now it's starting to come out that, in fact, Japan was preparing to surrender.
Oh, well, that's a lot
of
territory to cover
here. I'm sorry, yeah. That's it.
I mean, on the second question about the atomic bombing, yes, we in the book I wrote with Robert Lifton, we talk about the Hiroshima narrative, and what that is that we had to drop the bomb to end the war, and in fact, the bomb did end the war, and that has been pervasive down to the present day. Now, a lot of evidence has emerged over the years that has thrown that into a doubt, and you know, we could talk for an hour about that, but suffice to say that there is a large school of thought that believes that the U.S. did not go the extra mile to not use the bomb, that we could have waited for the Russians to enter the war as they did on August 7th, and that would have knocked the Japanese out. We could have told the Japanese in advance that they could have kept their emperor instead of waiting until after we dropped the bomb. It's complicated, but it's an interesting question that is, you know, very much in doubt now.
Or we could have dropped the bomb in a relatively unpopulated area.
Right. There's a lot to it, and it's not simple, and it's a terrific debate, if tragic, and you know, again, we could talk forever about that. On the first question about the book I wrote with Lifton, we talk a lot about the fact that even Truman, we even can see glimmers in Truman of regret and shame.
Yeah, that was a question that came to mind because I, you know, just like George Bush is kind of proudly swaggering about Iraq, no matter what happens there, he can't afford to say politically, he can't afford to say oops. Harry Truman certainly never did in public, at least.
Right. Well, but privately he did show some glimmers of that, and I think even Bush, I think, has to look at what has happened and have some doubts and regrets. I believe if he's a human being, maybe some people doubt that, but in any case, I think that there's a great many within the military and others, I think, who, you know, being there, seeing the carnage, seeing what we're up against, and particularly the opposition of many, if not most, Iraqis to our occupation, have to feel that, have to feel regret. And I think going back more than 2 years ago, I was one of the first to write a lot about comparing this to Vietnam. And of course, people said, you know, laughed at that and said, jungle versus desert and all those things. But what I was getting at even 2 years ago was that this was setting up to be a case where people get involved in this, and then they get more involved, and then they feel they can't leave, and they have to. We've heard from Bush just in recent days, you know, we have to honor the dead by staying the course. And then, of course, he said that when there were only 200 dead, and then there was 500 dead, and 1,000, and now almost 1,900. And of course, it's self-perpetuating, and it's in that way and many other ways that it is like Vietnam.
So will we have honored the dead when we have 50,000 dead?
Well, logically, you have to, you know, stay the course.
Yeah,
I suppose if you stay the course and then win, if such a thing is possible, so to actually win there, you know, then I suppose you could make that argument better. But when that is very, very, very much in doubt, it seems like a fool's mission.
Well, here, to bring this back to Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the situation in Japan, the Ayn Rand Institute, the kind of philosophical forebearers of the modern neoconservative movement, just published a piece by Yaron Brook, the president of Ayn Rand,
right.
Saying military historians may debate how much the bomb shortened the war and how many American lives were saved, but the fact is American lives were saved, and this is the reason America should be proud of its grave decision 60 years ago.
Right.
It's worth remembering, too, that in the reconstruction of Japan, there were no insurgents, no Japanese roadside bombs killing our soldiers. One reason is that the United States had shown, in the clearest possible terms, our willingness to wage total war against our enemies. Now, I have rebuttals for both of those. I'm curious what yours are.
Well, you know, again, it comes back to could the war have ended in the same time frame, you know, if not on the exact day and in the same, very much the same time frame without the use of the bomb? So I suppose if you believe that it's impossible that it would have taken another month or 2 months or 6 months, then you could make the argument that lives were saved, and then you could say, well, is it better to save American lives and take these Hiroshima lives or Japanese lives? But that comes back again to, you know, what could have ended the war and when. And so for the people who believe the war could have ended about the same time, that argument isn't so strong. I think what it comes down to is we know there was great deaths, or tremendous numbers of deaths in the Pacific and in that war, and we know that it was people were, you know, had gotten used to it, and we'd been firebombing cities, and so the argument is that this was just something on a slightly greater scale, and I understand that argument.
Isn't the reality that more people died in the firebombing of Tokyo?
True. No, a lot died, but not as many died. But I guess the point I was building up to is, and again, one of the main reasons that this footage was suppressed. Was that it shows very nakedly, sometimes literally nakedly, that the vast, vast majority of the victims in Hiroshima and Nagasaki were women and children. The myth has lasted to this day, really, that these were two army bases or two military cities, and yes, we know we killed some civilians, but these were legitimate military targets. But what the footage shows is that the vast majority, as was truthful, the vast majority were women and children, particularly in Nagasaki, which actually the odd fact is that more American and Allied POWs were killed by our bomb in Nagasaki than Japanese military.
But isn't that a function of the fact that the Japanese were in the end of a long war, there was a draft, all the men were gone? I mean, that would have been true of the firebombing of Tokyo, too, wasn't it?
I think there was more military in Tokyo and more men there, but still, it's still the fact of whether you can accept exterminating an entire city in a minute.
And we need to be reconsidering these continually. Thank you so much for being with us. I do appreciate it. Greg Mitchell, editor and publisher.com. Thanks, Greg.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
It's a hard night.
Yeah.
It's a hard night.
And it's going to get a whole lot worse if George Bush has anything to say about it.
It's for all my homies.
More tax cuts for CEOs, lower wages for average folks, more jobs moving to now Guatemala, Nicaragua, Costa Rica. Yes, can you spell CAFTA? 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Mike in Santa Barbara, California on the line. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks, Tom. Quick question. I think it was it the DVD, The Fog of War, about McNamara, where they listed all the cities that we had firebombed and the amount of Japanese we killed. And they were doing a comparison to, like, this would be the size of this city, and the bombing of this city would be the size of this city. And I can't remember that reference, and I'm sorry,
I didn't see the movie, Mike, so I don't know. I don't know what you're talking about.
But I think it was McNamara's The Fog of War, and they actually list the cities that we bombed and the amount of people that were killed. And I'd studied history. I'd never come across that or had found any reference to that or any information on that.
Well, and the same thing happened in Europe. I mean, this is one of the reasons why the Europeans are a little less enthusiastic about marching off to war than we Americans are, because we haven't been attacked on American shores since 1812, And the Europeans have, you know, they get it. I mean, the firebombing of Dresden, among other cities, I mean, that's the probably the most famous, was horrific. I mean, and our strategy during World War II, both in Japan and in Germany, was to break the will of the citizens by absolute, you know, by killing as many of them as possible, the firebombing strategies. And some would argue that that was successful. I actually have a different take on it. And, Mike, thanks for the call, and thanks for raising the issue. Here's my take on this, and you know, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think so, because I lived in Germany for a year. I have some sense of, you know, how the Germans think about World War II. And I have good friends in Japan, and I haven't lived in Japan. I've done a lot of work in Japan. I've spent a lot of time in Japan. And my take on it is, and this is why, by the way, my father was in the Japanese occupation. He was in, you know, he was there in Tokyo after the war, helping them rebuild the country. And they were not putting roadside bombs in and blowing up troops. And there was no insurgency in Japan, and there was no insurgency in Germany. We have not lost a single soldier in either of those nations as a result of a hostile insurgent response to us. Okay. And yet we've occupied both countries for, you know, 60 years now. So what's different between that and Iraq? In Germany and in Japan, in both countries, there was a cult. A cult, by any definition, a cult that was running the country. In the case of Japan, you had people who, you know, the kamikaze pilots, they were willing to die, to commit suicide, to fly their planes into the decks of our aircraft carriers. In Germany, you had the cult of Nazism. And, you know, make no bones about it. It was a cult. Blut und Erde, you know, blood and earth, the Aryan race, the whole thing. It was a cult. And the people got swept up into this the same way the people who drank the Kool-Aid with Jim Jones, the same way the people who get all swept up with Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, the same way that the people who followed Tammy Faye and Jim Baker. It was a cult. And what happened was that when Germany and Japan were defeated in the war, the people's belief in the cult disintegrated. They realized that the cult was wrong. They woke up from it. And it was like, it's like people who've been deprogrammed from cults in the United States, people who've gotten out of the Moonies, for example, and suddenly said, oh, wait a minute. You mean the Reverend Moon isn't the Divine Father? He's not here fulfilling the mandate of Jesus Christ? He's not the reincarnation of Jesus Christ? Oh, I've been brainwashed. I've been fooled. And that's why there was no insurgency in Japan and Germany, because those two nations were run by cult leaders who had essentially hypnotized their people. The people all bought into these cults and were willing to fight the wars based on that. And we popped the balloon of those cults. Not because we beat them into submission, not because we terrified them. And see, that's the mistaken belief. The McNamara during Vietnam, Rumsfeld now during Iraq, they believe if we can just terrify enough of the population, you know, with shock and awe, then they will behave like the Japanese and the German did. But I'm sorry, the Iraqis were not part of a cult. They weren't following a cult leader. Most of them didn't like Saddam Hussein. And they're nationalists. And so we're not going to see that kind of response. 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Is you glad you got nothing to feel? Is you glad that it's all so real?
Hey, babe, somebody shine on me. And welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. TomHartman.com, the website if you want to drop into our live chat room. Bonnie in Burgettstown, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Bonnie, welcome.
Oh, thank you, Tom. I'll be quick. Would you consider getting a DLC-type guest to debate like you have done with Evan Sayet?
We can
get one.
I got to tell you, we have been beating our heads on this. It used to be, during the election, the Republican conservatives would feed us guests with the Heritage Foundation and so on. They're a great resource. They will not send us anyone, or at least none of their referral people will come on the line. It's so difficult to find conservatives who will come online. Evan at least is willing to do that, and I tip my hat to him for that. With regard to the DLC, I know the guy who is in charge of their PR. I mean, I don't know him like an old friend kind of know him, but I've met him several times. We had lunch together once. And about a month ago or so, he sent me a list of like 14 or 16 members of Congress and some bunch of their advisors and all this, and says, here's a list of the people, you know, who we have available as guests. And they're feeding them to the media constantly. I mean, you know, half of the so quote Democrats, end quote, that you see on TV and radio shows are actually DLC fed to them, okay? And I said, I'll take any of them. I'll take any of them. He said, are you going to challenge them on DLC versus non-DLC issues? And I said, you bet I am. And he said, okay, I'll see who we can get. We've gotten nobody.
I believe it.
And it's like, you know, the cowardly Democratic Leadership Council Democrats and the cowardly Republicans, you know, they, you know, and so unfortunately, you know, that debate is not being had. I mean, you know, I'm pointing it out, but it's really a tragedy that these folks do not believe sufficiently in their own rhetoric to be willing to defend it on a program with somebody who at least is going to be willing to talk to them and, you know, hopefully make a point that's that makes sense once in a while. So,
right. And then two quick questions or comments.
Yeah.
Evan implied that a 12-year-old getting an abortion is really terrible, but many 12-year-olds aren't physically mature to deliver, and they can get, like, septic infections. And also he said that liberals have no
Well, his argument was that the parents should be making that decision, not the 12-year-olds. And,
and
in the ideal world, of course, that's the case.
That's right.
But the reality is that we don't live in an ideal world, no matter what Evan says. Yeah.
And he said that liberals have no morals, but he's trying to appeal to them. If he assumes liberals are fellow humans, surely he knows that if you're trying to appeal to somebody, you don't say they have no morals.
Yeah, and that was my original point to him. We'll see how this plays out over time. We'll see. Bonnie,
I'll be
thanks
listening.
A lot. Yeah, thank you. Thanks a lot for listening. I appreciate it, and for listening to us there on WPTT in Pittsburgh. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Bioneers are scientists and artists, gardeners and economists, activists and public servants, architects and ecologists, farmers and journalists, priests and shamans, policymakers and citizens. Bioneers are everyday people committed to preserving and supporting the future of life on Earth. They herald a dawning age of restoration founded in natural principles of kinship, interdependence, cooperation, reciprocity, and community. The website for Bioneers, bioneers.org. I'll be speaking at their conference this year, as will, I believe, Janine Benyus. Will you be there, Janine?
Yes, I will.
Great. Well, welcome to our program. Janine Benyus is the author of, am I pronouncing your name right?
Yes.
Oh, great. Is the author of 6 books in the natural sciences, including Biomimicry, Innovation Inspired by Nature. She's the co-founder of the Biomimicry Guild, where she works as a biologist at the design table, helping designers, engineers, and community leaders consult life's genius for more graceful ways to live on the earth. And her more recent projects include a Google of Nature's Solutions, a biology-taught functionality university course, and Royalties for Habitat program. Her home habitat is the Rocky Mountains of Montana. You identify 9 basic laws of the circle of life, and this isn't just, you know, airy-fairy New Age stuff. This is solid stuff about how we can create a society that actually works without destroying the world around us.
Yes. The idea behind biomimicry, Tom, is that it's a pretty obvious idea. It's, you know, after 3.8 billion years of evolution, life's grappled with the same kinds of challenges that we're grappling with, only they've had a lot longer. They're elders, and they've basically created environmental technologies that fit on Earth. A lot of trial and error. And 99% of species that were on Earth are no longer with us. You know, so the ones that are with us are A, lucky, but B, it's because what they've evolved works here. So biomimics are just innovators, scientists, researchers who are consciously trying to emulate this kind of genius.
So we look to the systems that actually work in the biological world, that actually work in the natural world, and say, oh, how can we do that with a machine? How can we do that in the context of transportation? How can we do that in the context of producing food? How can we do that in the context of heating our homes? How can we do that in the context of communication, things like that?
Exactly. Yeah, it's existence proof. I mean, I'm sitting here right now, I'm in Montana, and I'm watching a spider, actually, as I was waiting for this call, I'm watching a spider create a web, and the silk that it's creating, and it's silent, completely silent, and it's chemistry in water. It's happening, the chemistry is happening in its stomach, you know, and it's flies and crickets that it's fed on, and it's turning those into this fiber that is 5 times stronger, ounce for ounce, than steel. And yet, the chemistry that it does it with is so different than how we make, you know, if we were to make something that strong, it would be Kevlar.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, there's some sort of carbon fiber in this truck somewhere, but, and to make Kevlar, you know, we're taking oil products and we're heating it up to 1,400 degrees Fahrenheit in sulfuric acid and drawing it out under enormous pressures. And that Kevlar isn't even as much of a miracle material as that silk is, ounce for ounce. So basically, chemists and engineers and architects are starting to say, okay, well, how can we mimic, in the case of the spider silk, how can we mimic that? How can we mimic the recipe? How can we borrow that recipe and completely change the way we make fibers?
And not just the recipe, but the process by which the recipe is used.
And the process. Yeah, and the process. You know, there's sort of a split in the spider silk research these days in that some people are just saying, okay, well, let's just take the gene from the spider and put it, believe it or not, they're putting it into goats. Have you heard this?
Yeah, and then shave the goats. Is that
and then milking the stuff out of the goats. Now, that I don't consider biomimicry. I consider that twisted domestication, you know.
Yeah.
But there is a group in the UK, and what they're really trying to do is figure out, you know, literally take as if you'd borrow somebody's recipe and then remake their fiber manufacturing facility to work more like a spider's abdomen, rather than asking the spider to do our work for us, which is what domestication is. It's literally mimicking the process. That's one of the things material science is doing.
We're talking with Janine Benyus. Www.biomimicry.org is her website. Nature runs on sun. The 9 basic laws of the circle of life here. Nature runs on sunlight, Janine. We are ignoring massive amounts of sunlight, and not just the direct sunlight that falls on us, but the sunlight-produced actions like waves, tides, and winds that are energy from the sun that are here today and gone tomorrow that we could be capturing.
Exactly. And capturing it.
And using it.
About, again, I'm looking out, you know, I'm looking out at a lodgepole pine forest with grassland underneath it, and every single green thing I'm looking at is a distributed solar cell, you know, and people finally, you know, we didn't really understand how photosynthesis worked until the 80s, believe it or not. There's still parts of it that are mysteries to us. But we know enough now to crudely mimic photosynthesis. It's called artificial photosynthesis. And what they're creating, people, for instance, at Arizona State University are creating little molecular-sized solar batteries. And their first applications will probably be to do chemistry in sunlight,
mm-hmm.
water. But eventually, when you have something that small, you could think about painting it on the roof of a house, for instance, or on the highway system, any flat surface. So there is work going on to try to go to the sun, but to do it in a different way. I mean, even our PV cells, our photovoltaic cells, if you look at how they're manufactured, it's not necessarily toxin-free, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
So there's a better way to do even solar cells.
So we are sort of, at this point in time, our relationship with the technologies for capturing sunlight right now is not that different, perhaps, than our relationship with radio and radio waves was back in the days of DeForest, you know, back, 60, 80 years ago, 100 years ago, with giant vacuum tubes and arc generators and radios that you know, were clunky and weighed hundreds of pounds, and now we've shrunk all that down into a single integrated circuit. We're seeing increases in efficiency, increasing in orders of magnitude every year?
Yeah, exactly. Sure.
Now, you point out that nature uses only the energy it needs, one of your nine basic laws of the circle of life. What can we learn from that?
Well, you know, there are so many beautiful streamlining ideas in the natural world. I'll give you a couple. There's amazingly, you know humpback whales being out where you live. You know the fins on the humpback whale?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you look real close with binoculars, you'll see on the fin, the flippers actually, you'll see these bumps. You know, they're big bumps, and they're called tubercles.
Mm-hmm.
And a scientist at West Virginia University, his name was Frank Fish, believe it or not, is Frank Fish, and he said, this has got to be a drag reduction device. This has got to be a streamlining device.
Even though it looks like a bump that would seemingly interfere with the flow of water.
It does. It just looks like these random bumps. Well, anyway, he made a model airplane wing. Now, of course, that's going through air, but going through water, it's a similar process. It's
mm-hmm.
slow. And he put those bumps on his model airplane wing, and then he had a model airplane wing in the wind tunnel that didn't have the bumps. And it saved, the one with the bumps saved 32% energy.
Wow, why are we not putting bumps on airplane wings?
Well, Boeing's very interested in that research. Saving energy. Oh, there's so many neat ideas. There's a great company called PAC Scientific in San Francisco there, in San Rafael, actually. And what they're doing, they've looked at a ubiquitous geometry in the natural world, which is the logarithmic spiral. It's the Fibonacci sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Probably heard about.
Sure.
It's in everything, you know, and it's one of the things it's in is in the in seashells.
Like you see in the Nautilus itself. In particular.
Yeah, exactly. And like in a cone shell, if you eroded away the outside, you'd have that
mm-hmm.
spiral staircase. That's there because it's the best way for flow to go. Water can go up in there, and that soft-bodied critter can move up in there. And so Jay Harmon, a guy at PAC Scientific, decided to take that flow form, that geometry, and put it on a fan blade or a propeller or an impeller. And the air handling devices that he's now looking at, these are fans.
Mm-hmm.
He's getting increases in other words, I can put it this way, it uses 50% less energy, and it's 75% quieter.
Wow.
So that,
just imitating nature. What a surprise. What a concept.
Exactly. But, you know, I mean, R&D's been going on for very, very...
Right. Now, you point out that nature recycles everything. We have about 2 minutes left here, Janine. We're talking, by the way, with Janine Benyus, biological pioneer. Biomimicry.org is her website. Nature recycles everything, rewards cooperation, banks and diversity. What does this mean?
Well, those are three biggies. But the recycles everything and the cooperation and the diversity probably could all go together. That's this idea that there's no waste. Everything in the natural world, there are very few, there are only 20 amino acids, you know, and this building blocks are simple so that when these grasses, for instance, start to break down, their building blocks are such that they can be turned into insect bodies or fungal bodies or bacterial bodies. So it's actually upcycling. They get upcycled into products and into organisms' bodies, actually. But what's happening in our mimicry of it is what's called industrial ecology, which is this movement to put companies, co-locate companies in a food web and say, okay, if there's waste coming out your back door, can somebody take that waste and turn it into a product?
So a company that produces carbon as waste, you'd put next door to a company that uses carbon as a raw material.
Exactly. Exactly. And so what you're doing is...
Which is what nature does.
Sort of this upcycling. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a symbiosis.
They they upcycle into living beings, but
right.
We could upcycle those materials. But the trick is to make sure that the materials that we're using are able to be used over and over and over again without hazardous waste. I mean, so much of the stuff we're now sequestering because it's so toxic.
Right, because we render it toxic.
Yeah.
This is remarkable stuff. If you find it interesting, you can find out more at biomimicry.org, biomimicry, M-I-M-I-C-R-Y. Janine Benyus, Janine, thanks so much for being with us today.
You bet, Tom. Thanks for having your show.
Oh, my pleasure, and I look forward to seeing you at the Bioneers Conference, bioneers.org, their website. Thanks again, Janine. It is 10 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And where that foghorn blows, I will be coming home. Yeah, when the foghorn blows.
Oh, you tell a van.
I don't have the fear that I want to rock your gypsy soul.
And welcome back, my friends.
Just like way back in the days of old.
The great Van Morrison. Into the mystic.
And magnificently we will fold into the mystic.
Yes. In Texas, they can transmute barbecue into campaign gold. This is from the Washington Post. This is apparently the party that Cindy Sheehan may be spoiling. They're talking about arresting her on Thursday, perhaps. Declaring her a threat to national security. Why? Well, because Condi Rice and Don Rumsfeld may have to drive past her little encampment outside Crawford, Texas, where she's saying, Mr. President, I would like to know the answers to a couple of simple questions. What is this noble cause that last week you said our soldiers who died in Iraq died for? What is the noble cause? Oh, it's freedom. Freedom for whom? Freedom for the Iraqis? Well, we don't seem to be succeeding at that. All right, I'll just give it time. Well, is that really the national policy of the United States, that we travel around the world and wherever there's not freedom, we're going to bring it, even if it costs 1,800 American lives, 20,000 Americans maimed, 100,000 dead civilians, $300 billion of our treasure? And Mr. President, if this is such a noble goal, why are Jenna and Barbara, your daughters, not enlisting in the military as so many other women have across the United States who may live in situations where it's the only way that they can get a job or the only way that they might be able to pay for college education? Your daughters had that benefit. Why, you know, if this is so noble, why don't they show up? Somehow I have a feeling he's not going to meet with them. And Friday or Thursday afternoon, of course, Bush has his meeting. The Pioneers, who raise $100,000, the Rangers, who raise $200,000, and the Super Rangers, who raise $350,000, they're all getting together for a hoop-de-doop. And Bush and Rice and Rumsfeld are going to be there, and they just don't want Cindy around. She's a bit of an embarrassment. So we'll see how this thing plays out. It's getting interesting, folks. It's starting to get real interesting. Thanks for being with us today. Thanks to Scott Forrester for engineering our program, to Louise for producing it, to the folks in our chat room for showing up. Hey to all of you. Thanks to our sponsors, especially Small Dog Electronics, and our affiliates, all our affiliate stations. Thanks to you for listening. See you tomorrow, same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.